welcome to another episode of Sobre Mesa with me, your host, Alan Maguire. Today I have Christina Fletcher Fumanaya with me. She is the author of the book Democracy Reloaded, Inside Spain's Political Laboratory from 15M to Podemos. It's currently out with Oxford University Press. She's also the editor of Social Movement Studies Journal and a founding editor of Interface, an open access journal, which is related to political movements or movements in general. So welcome to Sobre Mesa, Christina.
Thanks so much, Alan. Thank you for having me.
So I really enjoyed your book. I moved to Spain in around 2015, 2016. And I saw like the end product of a lot of what's in your book, which I suppose famously is kind of Podemos, but there's so much more to this movement and this time, sort of 2011 onwards. So thanks very much for agreeing to come on and talk to me. What made you write the book to start with? Yeah, what spurred you on to write this book around this period?
Wow. I've been active in researching this movement community in Madrid for about 20 years now. Wow. Or more, actually, probably early 90s. And of course, when this happened, when this movement erupted, it was just this huge event that nobody could have anticipated. And a lot of people were kind of looking at it from the outside and making all kinds of assumptions about the movement. And as somebody who'd been involved in this movement community for so many years, it was clear to me, I mean, a lot of things weren't clear to me, but a lot of things that people were assuming about the movement, that it was completely spontaneous, that it was all new people, I immediately kind of said, wait a minute, that's actually not what's happening. So for me, it was about really trying to get inside the movement and try to explain the movement from the inside out, which is pretty much how I've always worked as an ethnographer of social movements. So I like to get inside deep and then try and figure out the internal logic, but then of course also take a step back and do critical analysis of you know, as a political scholar, of politics and social movements.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting that your book's got, you know, pictures of posters, you've documented a lot of what was on the signs and things. You can really tell that you, not only were you there, but you were there with your notebook and with a very open eye for certain things. At the start of the book, you talk a lot about the slogan, Real Democracy Now. Mm-hmm. And you sort of say, you know, as you just said as well, it wasn't this spontaneous thing on the 15th of May. It built up. There was protest before. So I just wondered if you could give us a bit of an outline of how this sort of movement and time really, well, it wasn't spontaneous, but also how it came together to be known as what is 15M or 15M. And why does it have that name as well?
Well, the name just comes from the date of the original protest. So that's an easy one. That's kind of common in Spain for a lot of kind of protest events are just remembered by sort of the number of the month and then the date, the letter of the month, basically. Uh-huh. But I think I'll take those, there are kind of a bunch of different questions in there. So in terms of the Real Democracy Now and sort of what does that mean and what was it about? I think 15M really represented a critique of really existing democracy, as you said. But at the same time, they were trying to reclaim the spirit and the concept of democracy itself. So it's a critique of the way things are, but it goes beyond critique to try to really rearticulate and understand democracy in a new way. So what do I mean by that? The global financial crisis really brought to the fore a lot of underlying questioning of democracy and progressive social movements. And you have to remember that at the time that the crisis hit, there was a very strong elite narrative about sort of the inevitability of austerity politics in the face of this crisis. And there were even narratives that developed about how people had been irresponsible, that they had taken advantage of easy credit to live beyond their means. So really trying to shift the blame from an unregulated and irresponsible banking and finance system that was shifting the blame for the collapse of the banking systems to individual citizens and making it out to be a lifestyle problem. And of course, if things are individual problems, then the state has no responsibility to actually address the underlying issues. So this was happening everywhere, but what was really different in Spain from some of the other countries like Ireland that were being hit by very similar narratives and similar circumstances was that in Spain, there was an activist network, a very long-standing activist network that was already prepared and motivated to react pretty much immediately against that narrative. And they immediately began to contest it. And they began to say, you know, this is not a crisis. This is not something that is the result of abstract, mysterious economic forces. This is the result of political decisions. This is a result of structural failures. And it's the result of collusion between political elites and economic elites. And above all, it's a fundamental failure of democracy to protect and serve the interests of citizens. So that slogan that they had, it's not a crisis, it's a swindle, no es una crisis, es una estafa, is a slogan that really captured that outrage at the fact that not only were people being forced to deal with the fallout from the crisis and from austerity politics, unemployment, losing their homes, et cetera, but that public money was being used to bail out private banks who through their own misbehavior had unleashed this crisis on the world in the first place. And in the context of Spain, this was very much tied into a critique of the culture of the transition, which I talk about in the book, of this story of the successful transition to democracy in Spain after the Franco dictatorship. And so people were really questioning that very limited procedural understanding of democracy as something that, you know, it consists of a few fundamental rights and you vote every 4 years for some political representatives. And that's kind of this bare bones essential liberal democracy model. So that demand, that slogan, real democracy now, were not commodities in the hands of bankers and politicians, which was on the banner at the original 15M protest. It really sums up that critique.
And you say that there was, the groups were already there to react. Were they activist groups, political groups, or political parties? Because, you know, the PSOE and the PP, so for the new listeners, that would be the Socialist Party, which is sort of more of a third way, new Labour, Democrats sort of type of socialist party, in inverted commas, and the PP, the Popular Party. You know, there was sort of this two-party system, wasn't there? But so who were the activist groups that were ready to react? And
it's pretty much a whole slew of groups on what you could broadly call a progressive left. So a bunch of movement groups on the progressive left the thing about autonomous movements in Madrid is that they might work on specific issues in their particular group. So they might be more interested in housing or feminism or this or that. But when it comes to bigger issues and bigger problems, they tend to come together and form alliances and kind of try to construct a united front, if you will, around particular issues. So it was a whole host of different groups, really a real wide range of them. And of course, people in occupied squats, which have always been very important in Madrid scene as well.
So this included the PA?
The PA pre-existed, but really became much more, dinamizado, it was much more dynamic after 15M exploded. And there came to be an interesting merging of 15M and the PA. So in the book, I include a chapter on the PA as sort of part of 15M, but also independent from 15M. So that's the case for a lot of the groups that I discuss. They have their own identity, but they also feel very much a part of this larger political movement and political subject, if you will. Because 15M is really best thought of, I think, as a collective actor. with a, and it's a movement, but it's also an identity.
And you talk a bit about in the book about the sort of the protests before 15M, and you said a minute earlier on it wasn't a spontaneous thing. What were they protesting against? Was there specific things? And could you just tell us, just spend a bit more on that?
Sure. So a lot of the initial impetus, I spent a lot of time talking about Youth Without Future in the book in the beginning, because they were really, really an important influencer group, small group.
Right.
And they were trying to get the youth to be sort of politicized. And it's an interesting thing because there's always been student activism, obviously, is the thing for, you know, everywhere. And there's always different waves of student activism. But the thing about student activism is that it's kind of doomed to be reborn from the ashes, because students only last every, you know, they go for 4 or 5 years and then they leave, and then there's a new crop of students and so on. So what Youth Without Future activists were trying to do was kind of say, well, it's not just about university students, which they had already been mobilizing against Bologna, mobilizing against sort of the commodification of higher education. They were also really concerned with many other issues that weren't just for university students, so that were issues of concern for youth in general, such as precariousness, unemployment, the fact that housing is completely inaccessible because of the costs, you know, especially in a place like Madrid, the costs of housing. So sin curro, sin casa, all these things on the slogan. What they were a series of different realities that they were saying, look, it's pretty much sucks to be a young person. We have no future. You've sold our future. And so they were trying to move beyond the university and really capture the youth. But of course the movement, even though it was youth led, very, very quickly became so much more than a movement about youth, you know, and there was an immediate intergenerational solidarity, where the parents of youth and the grandparents of youth were out there. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, it's not just the young people who can't, it's the pensioners who can't survive on their pensions. And it's, you know, all this whole series of issues that got plugged into this contestation against these austerity politics and this narrative that it was inevitable and that, you know, it had to be.
So these initial protests came together in 15M was, as you said, was the day of a protest. What was the aim of that protest, and what context did it take it in? And I think an important thing for it as well is that who were they protesting against?
Well, I think it's a kind of a cry to society to wake up, like most protests are of that nature. But also, of course, a direct rejection of government and economic and political elites, and saying, we're not commodities. You know, you can't sell our future down the road to bail out private interests and take away all the money that's supposed to be for citizen welfare at a time when people are losing their jobs and losing their homes. So it was, you know, it was a whole range of pent up frustration and critique, saying, you know, we have to do democracy in a different way. Hey, we need to get a conversation going about democracy. This one isn't working. But it's also about saying to the representatives, you know, you're not doing your job. You're supposed to be here helping and protecting citizens, and you're not doing that. You're failing, basically. So I think,
And this is around the time that the PP and the PSOE were more or less working together to try and manage this crisis with the EU. Is that right?
And fully committed and fully, fully committed to austerity politics without question. So there was no, there was really no established political party that was responding in any way to these kinds of demands, to these kinds of, you know, inquietudes, this feeling of malestar, bad feeling about what was happening.
And you talk quite a bit in the book about the protest turning into an occupation. And this is, I mean, then it's it was never called an Occupy camp, was it? Like we had Occupy in the UK, we had Occupy in New York, and
that's an English word that kind of got imported afterwards, because Acampada Sol is before any of the Occupies by quite a lot. So Occupy Wall Street was September 2011 and Acampada Sol was May 2011. So it's a precursor and it was an influencer of Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah, and they're often compared, but it seems that the 15M had a lot more, had a different kind of feel to it, like a different narrative of not just what they wanted, but you know what was happening. Could you talk a bit about the occupation of Sol and Campada Sol?
Sure. I mean, I think the difference is here again, it's going back to kind of what kind of movements existed already on the ground in Spain that really shaped what happened in the square. So I think, you know, it's one thing to say, look, we demand real democracy. And it's another thing to actually figure out what that looks like and how to create that. So 15M really was a political laboratory of experimentation around that challenge, that problematic. How do we build a real democracy? So it really moved from that procedural understanding of democracy, which is just about procedures. You know, you get to vote, you go every 4 years, these are your rights, to a really trying to get to grips with a substantive understanding of democracy. What does it mean to really live in a democratic way? So, and of course, you know, you were asking me before about sort of what was happening at the time in Madrid. And it's important to recognize that there were several influential events around the world as well that influenced the people who were in that square or who decided to stay in that square. One, of course, is Arab Spring, and especially Tahrir and the occupation of the square in Cairo. There was also WikiLeaks, which was a huge revelation and which many activists thought were going to really change everything. And then things didn't change. And they just thought, wait a minute, what's going on here? And then, of course, the saucepan revolution in Iceland, which was the first big pro-democracy, anti-austerity movement after the global financial crash, and very much tied into criticizing politicians, demanding a more robust democracy for the people, and a very successful in the short term. That was also a really big influence. So at 15M, you can also see signs that say, like, we can be Iceland, dreaming of Icelandic dream, and things like that. So the important thing is that those different movements and initiatives that were precursors to the 15M protest were also very much present in the square. But it was the decision to stay in that square that really changed everything. Because if everybody had just gone home, it would have been a good protest, but I think it just would have been yet another big protest in Madrid, which is not that, you know, significant. So the decision to stay and occupy that square, the Puerta del Sol, was what actually transformed this from a protest to an actual movement, to a whole movement. And there were lots of very experienced and skilled organizers involved there from the beginning. And they were able to channel the energy of all the newcomers coming in. And I describe in the book all the pedagogy, all the training, all the learning that they invested in sort of teaching people how to participate in the camp and in these kind of autonomous movements. So that's something that if you've been in those kind of movement spaces, you recognize immediately. But for people who have never been in them, they don't know how it works. So I describe that a lot in the book, you know, people going, what do you mean we don't vote? Like, what do you mean I have to speak? You know, who am I? And just that whole understanding of everybody having the right to participate and to have a voice. All of those things, sort of collective self-organization, collective self-empowerment. These are all things that are part and parcel of a long-standing tradition, but that none of the activists either had ever seen enacted in this mass way in this sort of huge public experiment in the middle of the city. So that, you know, not to that extent. There had been big occupations in Madrid before, as I say in the book, but not like that, not with those particular characteristics.
And you said they were training and but what were they experimenting with? I mean, you said that they were experimenting with democracy, but how were they experimenting? Have you got any examples that would be?
I mean, there's all kinds of things that people were doing. I mean, they were having the agoras en la plaza, which would mean the big assembly. So they were trying to take decisions collectively. Mm-hmm. A lot of what people were doing was very cathartic experience, which kind of drove some of the more, as I say in the book, you know, some of the more experienced activists were getting very frustrated with the sort of endless catharsis. But of course, for the people who had nobody to tell their story to, who were maybe stuck isolated in a flat in Madrid, to be able to find themselves in a place where people were listening to them while they told their story of what had happened to them, maybe they had lost their job, their home, you know, how the crisis had affected them. That was a big part of it. But it was also about trying to collect proposals about how can we improve democracy. So they collected hundreds of thousands of proposals, which I don't know exactly where those boxes ended up, actually. I don't think anybody does. They're probably in a squat somewhere in Madrid, but that's not really the point. The point is that you're engaging thousands of people in this process of really trying to come to grips with democracy. What does it mean? How can we make it better? So it's about creating this huge discussion and questioning of democracy, which is quite a remarkable thing in and of itself. But then of course, there's also the material organization of the camp. So the very fact of having communal childcare, having a communal kitchen, running a free library, communal library, all of those things are on one level very simple, taking care of material needs, but on another level, doing it in that way collectively really is a very radicalizing and politicizing experience, because you start to question how it's done when you're not in the square, and you start questioning things like, well, hey, you know, maybe it is better when we do things together, or why am I so isolated? Why do I have to face these problems on my own? So, yeah, I think there was a lot of different, you know, people were doing yoga. I mean, people were doing just every possible thing. If you look at the key to the camp that's included in the book with the map, you can see all the different assemblies and all the different working groups. So it was very open. I mean,
and it expanded beyond Sol, is that right? And what was the rest of Madrid like as well at that time?
Well, that's a really good question, because Sol was just kind of the ground zero. But it was being fed, and I described this in the book as well, like the resources that were going into that camp to keep it going were coming also from a network of squatted social centers, different groups, different assemblies, different people providing generators, you know, furniture, tarps, everything you might need to keep that going, was connected to all these other projects and little collectives and things happening in the city that would then come into the camp, become connected with other people in the camp, and then go away stronger, if you will, because more people knew about them, they knew about more people. And so it really had an impact, not just on the square, but as you say, all around Madrid.
And what was the reaction to this, the occupation? What was the reaction of the authorities and the general public like to 15M?
Well, in the beginning, I think most people just ignored them, because in the beginning, it was just a small group of people. They were having their assemblies. So what? You know, there's so many, there's always been many assemblies and many things there in Madrid. But the real changing point came when the police tried to evict them. And when the police tried to evict them, that's when so kind of the word got out. The young people are being evicted and people fled, you know, flooded down there to support them. And that's when really the camp took off. Because kind of overnight they went from being, you know, 40, 60 people to a couple thousand people. And then it became, you know, this, it just turned into this huge thing where we're not leaving. And it became an act of civil disobedience as well. So again, civil disobedience, time-honored movement tradition, you know.
Yeah.
Taking your claim and saying, you know, we're not actually going to leave. And they tried to get them to leave on the day of reflection. And that you may have seen that photograph with all the hands up in the air, the silent scream, which was, they were saying, we are reflecting, you know, we are thinking about elections. We are thinking about democracy, but we're not doing it alone in our homes like you want us to. We're doing it together in this square. And we're making a stand, we're taking a stand and making a statement about demanding a better democracy than the one that you're providing for us.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
The election that happened, it didn't really reflect 15M very well. Like,
yeah, it was, I have to go back and look at all the exact outcomes. But yeah, it was, people were saying at the time, oh, 15M took away the vote and this and that, which I think that's just, you know, ridiculous. It wasn't about voting, you know, 15M at that stage really, I mean, it was about electoral reform. There were certainly things in the manifestos that related to electoral reform and thinking about actually procedural elements as well of democracy in Spain, but that wasn't really the point. And no, it didn't get reflected at all. And it's interesting because, you know, if there had been any kind of institutional change or reaction or absorption of these demands, Podemos would never probably have had any space to develop later on. But it was because the established parties were so uninterested and unreceptive to what was happening on the streets that they ended up, you know, shooting themselves in the foot. And there's a famous, you know, quote, I can't remember, but I think it was Esperanza Aguirre, who were saying, oh, you know, this is democracy. Elections are democracy, not that business that they're doing down in the square. If they're so interested in democracy, they should start their own party. So, you know, fast forward 3 years and it's like, well, you told us to start our own party, so here we are.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they're thinking, damn, you know.
The original camp lasted about a month.
Yeah.
You know, lots of activities spread out further. I think a big important part of it is the continuation of what happened afterwards, you know, what this really started get going. Well, I mean, that's why it's famous, isn't it? Because it really kick-started what came after. Now, the famous one is Podemos, which we'll talk about in a minute. But can you just talk a bit about the other things that came out of 15M, whether it's movements or just a feeling or...
Yeah, I mean, if you look in the book, there's that map, which I think is a really interesting map, which is called a self-generated map. In other words, people are invited to contribute their own group or project that's related to 15M to that map. And that's how that map was constructed. Uh-huh. And you can just see the range of issues and groups that were felt connected to 15M and the Acampada Sol, but obviously also had their own identity. And that goes everything from sort of fighting for medication for hepatitis C to fighting against the privatization of water, to the PA, to the neighborhood assemblies, which of course was how the movement originally organized following when they decided to leave Sol, they went into the neighborhoods. And that's another difference from other cities is that in Spain, they planned the decamping so that there would, so that the movement and the assemblies would have somewhere to go once they were not in Seoul anymore. So that was another important thing. And that's a longstanding tradition as well of sort of neighborhood organizing in Madrid, which was also part of it. And also the squatted social centers were again, really important spaces for movement activity. So a whole slew of different projects and, you know, even bicycle repair collectives, you know, I mean, just all kinds of things, but that all had sort of a political aspect to them and that were committed to working in the 15M way. And of course, working in the 15M way is working horizontally, sort of all the autonomous principles, direct action, working autonomously, unmediated politics, that sort of thing.
And you mentioned it that more at the end of the book, you talk about how social media played a part in all this. What was around at the time and how was it used?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, social media is really important in organizing all aspects of our lives. So certainly, and certainly politics. So of course it was incredibly important as a tool for organizing the movement as well. But in the book, what I'm trying to show is that a lot of the narratives about the movement and these movements in general that really prioritize the role of social media or privilege it are really off track, because the heart of the movement through its entire development is certainly in Madrid, still lay in that face-to-face organizations in the spaces of social movement communities. And social media also developed more importance as the movement developed. So one thing that we know from research is that when people initially were in the square, very few of those people actually had Twitter.
Right.
But by the time they left the square, pretty much all of them had Twitter, right? So it was also kind of a place where people were, that techno-political and hacker ethic was a big part of the movement. And a lot of people were exposed to that movement tradition in the square. So that became more and more important. And it's true that there were some very tech savvy activists present from the very beginning. They set up a Twitter account at the very beginning. But again, the way that they use media in autonomous movements is a particular, it's still connected to that autonomous movement culture, which is to say that you don't get to just do whatever you want. You're supposed to be receptive to the assembly, and you're trying to serve the assembly rather than hijack a process and just put out whatever you want. You're supposed to actually be reflecting what the collective wants and what the collective is trying to transmit now. And I think they did a pretty remarkable job of that, actually. But again, very experienced and also very steeped in autonomous political culture, which is kind of gives you those rules. And hacker ethics, which also are sort of a set of guidelines and way of being, like all ethical guidelines, that shape the way that social media is actually used in the movement. So,
and it plays, I mean, that sounds like, and it has like, you know, knock-on effects you can see in other parts of the movement as well. I mean, there's Party X, Partido X. And Podemos had a lot of online voting, and you know, Carmena's online referendums for works in Madrid, in you know, in municipal municipalism movement.
Absolutely, I mean, techno politics is really important in Spain, and it's an important part of the movement, and it's reflected in the way that the movements operate, but it is only one strand that we can't forget. Feminism, we can't forget autonomous movements as well. I think that, you know, those three strands are the most strong. Some other important, at least at the time, were sort of environmental movements and anti-militarist movements. So they were very much there, and it's, and also anti-race, racism movements, but they're very much there, but they weren't so central, I don't think.
And as you said, the feminist movement and the assembly movement were, you know, two big strands of, that came out of 15M. How did they develop from the occupation to what they've become? I mean, so today, you know, we have Podemos, but we also have the other like end factors of those things as well. So how did those strands develop?
Well, I think that the interesting thing about the square, again, it kind of, you have to really keep going back to the square. And what ended up happening was that, say, for feminism, there were always lots of small feminist groups of different kind of flavors and varieties in Madrid.
Uh-huh.
What happened is that with the Acampada Sol, they all came together and they came into contact over a period of time. And they made a decision early on, which I think was really, really brilliant, to set aside all the things that separated them and to focus on all the things that they shared in common. And one of the things that they experienced, of course, any kind of camp, and especially in the middle of a big city, it's a microcosm of the city, and it has a lot of the problems and distortions and that the city has. So they were experiencing sexism, they were experiencing sexual aggression, for women who were trying to sleep in the camp overnight were getting hit on and assaulted. There were a lot of issues with people misunderstanding, so kind of a one universalism means you don't talk about feminism. No, you know, democracy isn't democracy unless everybody has the same rights and freedoms and true freedoms, which clearly isn't the case under a patriarchal society. It's so they were realized very early on, hey, oh my God, this is never going to truly be a democratic revolution if these people don't wake up to some basic feminist principles. So they began to mobilize very much within the camp. And I think one of the long-standing effects on movements and also on politics in Spain of the 15M, and one that's not talked about nearly enough, is this real resurgence and strengthening of feminism in Spain. And that has been a tremendous impact. And one just sort of curious detail, one of the things that they decided as sort of a radical linguistic political move was to speak in plural feminine,
right,
as opposed to plural masculine, which is the universal sort of supposedly universal, but leaves out half of us, way to do it. So, you know, for a long time there, it was like todos y todas, right? Like we would say masculine plural, then feminine plural. And they're like, no, well, you know, screw that. We're just going to make a political statement here, and we're just going to jump to the feminine plural. So they started speaking in feminine plural, and pretty much all the assemblies started speaking in feminine plural. And even several years after the square was lifted, if you would drop into an assembly in Madrid, I'm not sure the extent to which that is still the case today, but you drop into an assembly and everybody in that assembly, regardless of gender, would be speaking in feminine plural and writing their texts in feminine plural as well. So that's, you know.
Yeah.
It might seem like a small thing, but it's actually a really radical in language shapes. Obviously, language shapes are very conception of the world. So when we alter language, we alter our conception of the world as well.
I mean, I suppose as well, like you said, the end product of that has been the huge, for the last 4 or 5 years now, is the 8M marches, the 8th of March, Women's Day strike. Spain had the first women's strike. And, you know, I don't think any of that would have been possible without 15M.
I mean, there is a very long tradition of feminist activism in Spain that predates 15M, but I do think that 15M gave it a real surge, you know, it gave it a real boost of energy. And as I say, it brought together a lot of different strands that had been working independently and brought them together to start working in a more transversal, pluralistic kind of way.
Mm.
So I think that the influence that they were able to have was enormous, thanks to the square and thanks to sort of being able to transform the consciousness of so many people in that 1 month period. And they did an amazing job of it, obviously, because people don't just have their consciousness changed spontaneously. Their consciousness is changed through consciousness raising activities.
Yeah. So,
yeah, they did an amazing job.
And I suppose this sort of links very well to the other strand, which is the neighborhood assembly. So, you know, the planned deconstruction of the camp. And I mean, that links, I think, to another legacy that is often overshadowed a bit by Podemos because it's very interlinked into it, but that's municipalism as well. That sort of, you know, a lot of the big local governments, you know, Barcelona, Madrid, but, you know, all over Spain, were being run by collective groups and assemblies. How did it go from being a camp in Sol to, you know, the assemblies in the neighborhoods to municipalism? How did that process take shape?
Very problematically. I mean, I remember it really kind of torpedoed a lot of assemblies because when people were asked to create lists, I mean, well, you have to think about it. You've got a horizontal assembly where there are no leaders, right?
Uh-huh.
And suddenly you're being asked to configure a list which has somebody at the top and somebody at the bottom and everybody in between. And only the most voted are going to get in to a position and so on. So it inserts a vertical hierarchical logic into a horizontal system. And there were huge, you know, in some collectives, there were definitely huge fights and debates. And again, people saying, well, no, all the number ones of all of them should be women because we're supposed to be trying to transform what usually happens and the underrepresentation and so on. And people say, oh no, but you know, that doesn't work. And, you know, there were all kinds of issues. And also, of course, there was a lot of resistance from autonomous activists who did not want to be involved in electoral politics. I mean, of any kind. The whole point of autonomy is that up until, you know, we can talk about now hybrid autonomy, which is kind of this mix, and municipalism kind of has elements of that. But a lot, you know, a lot of people are like, well, I don't want to be part of established political politics, you know, established politics and parties. So it was a lot of negotiations and huge amounts of behind the scenes work. With Podemos being a player for sure, an important player, a heavy player within that process, but by no means the only player, and having to contend with many, many other groups.
Yeah, like the PAS were quite involved, and you know, a lot of feminist groups and things like that.
Yeah,
before they were, as you said, torpedoed by municipalism, what were the assemblies trying to accomplish in the neighborhoods that wasn't, you know, like as an extension of 15M? What were they doing in these autonomous assemblies?
Well, I mean, a lot of them, it depends, you know, assemblies, the neighborhood assemblies would deal with neighborhood issues of all kinds. So they could be dealing with housing issues, they could be dealing with evictions, they could be dealing with social welfare issues, lack of representation or people paying attention to them on the local councils, all sorts of things. But they also, as I discuss in the book, there were different issues that were kind of hot button issues that were coming out. Preferentes, which were mostly pensioners who had lost their life savings because bank managers had been instructed to call them and target them to move their life savings over into these very high risk investments These people were working class people, loads of them working class people. Some of them had very limited literacy. I mean, it was all kinds. It was really shocking. And so they began to organize. So that's another great example of how it's not just a youth movement. You know, that's why I start those, the sort of substantive chapters after the square. I start with the old pensioners, because it's, I want to really show that intergenerational connection, and that it wasn't just a movement by and for young people, that it was much, much broader than that.
And municipalism sort of took over, taken on its own life, I suppose. A lot of movements ended up in electoral politics. And I suppose the real, I mean, the other strand that isn't municipalism or technopolitics is Podemos.
Right.
How did Podemos, I mean, Podemos is obviously world famous now. But how did it come out of 15M? Because often if you ask a Podemos politician, oh, you're the party of 15M, they'll often say something like, well, no, we're not. Well, we sort of are. But they always sort of fudge their answer a bit. Or they always never directly say yes or no. It's always a bit like, well, you know, we're around the same time. And why is it that they answer like that? And how are they connected?
Because they answer like that because they're not fools, and they know that they have to tread a very careful and fine line between channeling the spirit of 15M and sort of thereby in some way representing the movement, but at the same time not fagocitar, how do we say this in English, not co-opting the movement for their own self-interest. So that's the line they need to walk. They can't just say, oh yes, we're the movement of 15M, because then people will say, well, that's ridiculous. 15M is not a movement about parties and so on. So the key puzzle that I address in the book, for that part of the book about Podemos, is exactly that question. So how could so many members of a movement that was radically committed to critiquing representative democracy, and so adamant about their autonomy from parties and unions, less than 3 years later, embrace this Podemos electoral initiative while still claiming allegiance to the spirit and identity of the movement? So that's the genius of Podemos, is their ability to convince these activists to join this project. And I devote a lot of time discussing how they do that in the book. It was probably the most challenging chapter to write. It took me a really long time to figure and analyze how they did that. But what I show is how early risers in this electoral turn engaged in very extensive discursive work to enable those 15 activists, 15M activists, to overcome their cognitive dissonance, you know, their internal struggle, and realign their activist identities to embrace this electoral parties and municipal movements for change, as they're known in Spain. And so in the book, I described, you know, step by step, a lot of the different discursive strategies and arguments that were made. So they had a lot of, Podemos activists were drawing on some key sources of legitimacy and discursive persuasion. So they would emphasize the roots of the party in 15M. They would guarantee the incorporation of key demands and elements of 15M culture. So you were saying before that they had a lot of, initially they had a lot of participatory tools and digital tools. That was all very palatable to techno-political activists who saw digital tools as a way of increasing democracy. They emphasized the activist credentials of the party leadership, which is absolutely true. Party leaders are all activists I've known for years and years and years in Madrid. They also really blurred that binary distinction between social movements and parties. So they were constantly blurring that line. And then they also had a narrative that Ada Colau was actually really one of the people who articulated this most coherently, well, she's brilliant at articulating things coherently anyway, but it was sort of this narrative about the moral imperative to save democracy for the people. Mm-hmm. So it's like the reluctant politicians, these are reluctant politicians who are forced by a moral imperative to save democracy and to not leave politics in the hands of politicians. Uh-huh, that, uh-huh. You know, that was the narrative. But that was also coupled with an incredible level of frustration that every other avenue had been exhausted and the established political parties were simply not listening. They weren't changing anything. They were not changing their minds about austerity. They weren't changing their minds about democratic transparency. Mm. There was still corruption. There's still, you know, and so kind of that, all of those elements came together.
Yeah.
And obviously with a very talented set of political activists who saw an opportunity, saw that no other parties were taking, you know, any notice of this huge social force and political force, and they channeled it and they did it and they did it brilliantly initially, especially.
Yeah. And I think that's an interesting addition there, the initially part, because, you know, Podemos really has changed since, you know, winning those MEP seats, the Minister of European Parliament 2014 was their big sort of entrance onto the political stage or electoral politics. How has it gone since then? And how has it changed since 15M?
Well, it's changed enormously. I mean, Podemos, one of the things they did in the beginning was they didn't even call themselves a party. They started off as a citizens initiative. Uh-huh. And they said, look, we're not gonna put anybody forwards for any kind of elections unless the people say they want it. So they were very much the people decide, mm-hmm. very 15M-y about the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And they had all those circles, uh-huh. Which were just assemblies. But they called them circles so that it would be part of their project and so on. Those have mostly disappeared. But of course, most of the assemblies have also disappeared. So that's not, you know, that's not just a phenomenon with the Podemos. But Podemos is, you know, in the book, I have the chapter called Podemos, a hybrid party, ? Right? Uh-huh. Hybrid party or movement party. By which I mean a party that seeks to maintain links to, but also characteristics of, participatory democratic social movements, but at the same time being fully committed to winning elections, not just presenting symbolically, but actually winning them. So clearly all those early commitments to the base of the party, to being sort of committed to the participatory, to the internal democracy of the party, most of that has gone by the wayside. Once they saw that they had sufficient support from the electorate, they increasingly bypassed any internal opposition, any consultation, any internal democracy. And, you know, in any party, there's always internal struggles and factionalisms. They weren't handled well in Podemos. It's cost a huge amount of human capital. A lot of people who could have contributed, I think, or who were contributing, have progressively left. So they're left with a much reduced and impoverished, in my opinion, party. But, you know, having said all that, it's still they've still achieved something absolutely remarkable. Mm-hmm. And historically, certainly, you know, would we rather not have a Podemos? God, no. You know, I mean, can you imagine what the pandemic response would have been without a Podemos? I mean, I think having them there is absolutely, you know, essential. Mm-hmm. But the current situation is somewhat paradoxical in government that supports and stands for some of the key demands of the 15M movement in terms of progressive social policies around social welfare, healthcare, minimum wage, housing, etc. And yet has really lost almost all of the elements of the participatory democratic experiment that characterized that movement and those movements in the squares. So they're only a movement party in the sense that they still support progressive movement agendas, And people like Ione Belarra still reach out to social movements very actively, but they don't function internally like a movement. They function like a party, and a very presidentialist party organized around Iglesias's leadership.
Yeah, and I suppose that's sort of the part I enjoyed about your book the most was, and I really didn't know, because I was under the impression 15M was literally just all these protest movements sort of coming together. But I think your book really emphasizes as well the democracy element of 15M. And it's often something that's forgotten about. And it's also something I've heard a lot of people that were really, you know, pro Podemos, eager, you know, to engage with Podemos at first, have left or have lost interest because they lost that democratic sort of element to them. Which seems like a huge shame, really.
I mean, it is a huge shame. I mean, I understand a lot. I mean, you know, a lot of things have happened, and I'm always torn because I do understand, especially when it was a very fledgling project, which could so easily be co-opted by other left forces and could so easily be scuppered before it ever got started. And I think that fear, I think that legitimate fear actually, was already there in Vista Alegre 1. And unfortunately that fear has dictated or taken the lead over these years, not to the benefit of the party, not to the benefit of, you know, the movement. In the sense that if you notice, their electoral fortunes have gone down every single election since they started.
Yeah.
Their share of the electorate is also shrinking progressively as they've lost people and energy from within.
An interesting question that came to me earlier on that I never asked as well was, why did a new party come out of this rather than, you know, Izquierda Unida, which is essentially the Spanish Communist Party or the big Spanish Communist Party?
Yeah.
Why weren't they able to challenge the energy of 15M?
No, that would never have worked. The whole point of 15M initially, you have to understand that when 15M started, they very much had a similar narrative to what the Greens had in Germany when they started, which is to say, not that they were a green movement, but which is to say, the Greens always said, we're neither left nor right, we're out in front, right? That was the way that the Greens framed themselves. Of course, the Greens were on the left, and eventually they went more and more left. That's exactly what happened with the movement. The movement initially was genuinely committed to trying to reach across those cleavages in Spain between left and right, and to reach out to people who were suffering because of the crisis, who were suffering or had critiques of the government, regardless of their ideological orientation.
Mm-hmm.
So if you present yourself as a new, a new political party in Spain, you absolutely cannot identify with any pre-existing established party on the left or the right, because the cleavages in Spain from the Spanish Civil War are still so deep that they shape everything. So for me, and I say this in the book, Podemos's worst mistake was the confluence, was the decision to join with Izquierda Unida. That's my reading. I think that was a tragic mistake. And the moment they did that, they lost any capacity to present themselves to the public as a genuinely new, fresh, clean start of a non-corrupt, pro-democracy, progressive party. They just were not able to do that, because even though I very much like, you know, Izquierda Unida's leader and everything, has nothing against the, you know, the politics or whatever, but it doesn't play in a country where, you know, Izquierda Unida was involved in the Tarjetas Black scandal. So, you know, you can't say that you're overcoming the corruption of the past, of the big unions and the big parties, and then join up with one of the parties that has been tinged with corruption and is very much identified with one side of the Spanish Civil War, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, it's a...
No, that's a question that I've been asked a few times. So no, thanks for clearing that up. And other than Podemos, which is, I suppose, one of the big sort of hallmarks that's left over from 15M, what would you say are the lasting effects of the 15M movement?
Well, I think that it triggered a public conversation about democracy, which had never taken place. Really, people had accepted the transition and weren't thinking much beyond that. Mm-hmm. I mean, how long lasting the effect of that is, who knows? It's very hard to measure consciousness, you know, the transformation of consciousness. But you have to think, millions of people took to the streets in Spain, literally millions of people took to the streets in that as participants in that movement. Mm. And many hundreds of thousands passed through squares around Spain. So that leaves a legacy in the way that people see the world. It leaves a legacy in social capital in the sense that it creates new connections between people. So networks are transfigured and transformed. Mm-hmm. Of course, in terms of formal politics, the strength of the municipal movements has been remarkable. And that has also transformed institutional politics. If you think about the fact that at the time that Manuela Carmena and Ada Colau, they were running the two largest cities, huge economies, mm-hmm. being run with great fiscal, their success. Mm-hmm. They reduced, they wiped out all the bloat and deficit. I mean, they mm-hmm. did social welfare, and they demonstrated that you could have a very progressive social welfare agenda for much less money and reducing deficits and so on and so forth. So I think that the fact that they are both explicitly feminist politicians mm-hmm. and who made no attempt to hide or soften their language about feminism, really mainstreamed feminism, I think that's hugely important. And just, the experience, the shared collective experience of the movement and all the other myriad projects it had an effect on culture. If you look at this La Casa de Papel, Money Heist series, the big hit around the world, 15M is referenced in that. Uh-huh. There's references and influences in that also through with the masks, which are the Dali mask, but they're mm-hmm. also like anonymous masks. So, there are myriad impacts of the movement. And I think we're heading into a situation now in Spain and around the world where the extreme right is really just gaining ground. And the established parties are just not living up to any, they're really defunct at this point. Mm-hmm. I don't see much hope for any of the established parties in really being able to galvanize or motivate or transform. And so I think it's a good time to kind of look back at 15M and to think about what happened and how it happened and how it worked. Mm-hmm. And, hopefully learn some lessons or provoke some kind of reflection around that.
Yeah,
I hope the book does that.
No, it definitely does. And thank you very much for joining me. Thanks very much for letting me interview you.
Yes, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks again for joining me, Christina. And if you were wondering what elections we were talking about 20 minutes into that interview, it was actually municipal elections that were held on the 22nd of May, not the general election in November. However, as we said in the interview, the PP did make gains in both the municipal elections, but huge gains in the national elections. Christina's book, again called Democracy Reloaded, Inside Spain's Political Laboratory from 15M to Podemos, is available on with Oxford University Press. I'll put their link on my website. She's also got two other books out that she's been involved with. Social Movements in a Globalized World, second edition, which is Will of Palgrave Macmillan and Red Globe, and that was out in March 2020. And The Handbook of Contemporary European Social Movements, Protest in Turbulent Times, was also out in 2020. So Christina is obviously very busy. Thanks again for listening to the Sobremesa podcast. If you like anything about contemporary Spain, also the history of Spain, but political and progressive movements, then please do subscribe to this podcast. We're always looking out for contributors with something interesting to say about Spain. So if you want to get in touch, it's the Sobremesa podcast with dots in the middle. So it's the.sobremesa.podcast@gmail.com. Feel free to get in touch and I will do my best to get back to you and arrange an interview. Between now and March, we'll probably have an episode every week. We've got coming up municipalism, a bit of a deeper look into municipalism, and the rise of Vox, so the other side of what you've just heard. And we will also be looking at regional politics in the run-up to the Catalan elections in February. I hope you have a great week. Thanks for listening.